You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I'm Kemal Kirişçi, the TÜSİAD Senior Fellow leading the Turkey project here at Brookings. We are well aware that there are very good competing events on Turkey today elsewhere in Washington, D.C. So we're very grateful that you're here, and I'm hoping that this will be an event that will make your presence worthwhile here. We are meeting at, historic times. You may have just heard that two, luckily only small, explosions have occurred in Ankara yesterday, just 2 days before the long-awaited announcement from Abdullah Öcalan, the leader of the PKK, who is currently imprisoned on the island of İmralı in Istanbul. I do not have any intentions going into the details of the Kurdish question, but nevertheless I wanted to just make a few broad observations on how we have come where we are before I turn the floor to the panelists. I do believe, as someone who has studied the problem for a while, we are at a historic crossroads. We are talking about a country that until just about two decades ago denied the actual existence of Kurds and the Kurdish identity. Early 80s, we saw the beginning of a long period of violence. When the European Union finally decided to engage Turkey as a candidate country for membership in 1999, was also the year when Abdullah Öcalan was apprehended and sentenced first to death, but because of the EU process, the death sentence was commuted to a life one. And together with that, Turkey embarked upon a reform process that saw modest but important reforms to support Kurdish cultural rights being introduced. This was roughly the early 2000s up to mid 2000s. And then the current prime minister of Turkey seemed determined to address the Kurdish problem, to take, if you wish, the bull from its horns, approach it from a political perspective. In the summer of 2009, we saw the launching of what came to be known as, in a translation from Turkish, the democratic opening. However, that opening very quickly fizzled away when this incident at the Habur border crossing with Iraq occurred that saw the return of PKK militants. But the manner in which they returned back to Turkey and it was hoped into regular politics unleashed a nationalist backlash in Turkey. I think this is the point at which I'm going to stop, because our first speaker, Aliza Marcus, that I'm sure you're very familiar with, from her columns, particularly on the Kurdish question in leading international newspapers, but much more importantly, her book, Blood and Belief, that focuses on the Kurdish nationalist struggle, will address precisely what is going on today. How did we come where we are? What are the details of the negotiation process that's going on? And we agreed that Aliza will take a somewhat critical, if not maybe a bit cynical, view of the negotiation process. Our next speaker will be Ömer Taşpınar. I need not introduce him to you. You're very familiar with Ömer. Ömer is going to try to challenge Aliza's position.
Fail.
And maybe take a position somewhat a bit more closer to mine, that this is a historic moment, and hopefully on this occasion a breakthrough will, or at least a breakthrough as far as a process that might bring us to a I find resolution a very difficult, tough word to use, but somewhere closer to a solution of the Kurdish problem. And lastly, Gönül Tol from the Middle Eastern Institute, Middle East Studies Institute, who leads the Turkey Studies program and teaches at George Washington University. Gönül writes extensively on a very fascinating aspect of the Kurdish issue in Turkey right now, Turkey's relations with northern Iraq, the Kurdish regional government. And I think it would be very difficult to understand, appreciate, comprehend where we actually are today without looking at Turkey's relations with the Kurdish regional government in northern Iraq. So I don't wish to take up any more of your time. I'd like to turn the floor to Aliza. Aliza, we have 10, 12 minutes to take a critical view of what's going on right now.
Thank you, Kemal.
Thank you, Aliza.
Tomorrow, Abdullah Öcalan is supposed to issue a message via BDP that may or may not call for a ceasefire and some sort of phased withdrawal. This is a very risky time for analysts like myself to actually say anything, because for once you can hold me to a standard. Did I get it right or did I get it wrong? Which is why, perhaps one reason, I don't want to discuss the actual messages, the contents of the message, although I will touch on them. But I want to talk about the dangers I see in this process. And my opinion, which is that Erdogan has really tried to stage manage this process, that essentially he's trying to come to an accommodation as opposed to actually negotiate and come to a peace deal. And what I think Erdogan is missing, what the prime minister is missing right now, is the point is you don't get a deal on the cheap. The Kurdish problem is something that has been going on now in one form or another for nearly a century, really for, you know, even before the Turkish Republic was formed. The PKK is actually in a very strong position. Militarily, it did very well last year. If anything, there was almost a stalemate between the PKK and the Turkish military in terms of attacks and casualties. The group remains well-financed. It's well-equipped. There's no problem getting new recruits. What's been going on in Syria, which I think Gunel will touch on more, has really strengthened the PKK because really for once on the ground it's managing territory and it's gaining both support, experience, and a certain international legitimacy from that. And at the same time, Kurds in Turkey are highly politicized now. They've had years to develop a real political outlook. So we don't know exactly what Öcalan's message will be tomorrow, but one thing we do know is that whether or not it reflects actual Kurdish demands, it actually reflects what Turkish intelligence and what the prime minister want. And this, to me, doesn't bode well for a successful peace deal. Why do I say that it reflects their views for sure? Because they've stage-managed this. They've gone to out of their way to choose Öcalan as a negotiating partner as opposed to BDP, which is a legitimate representative, elected representative, of the Kurds. Erdogan has gone out of his way to actually elevate Öcalan, to almost recreate him in the dictatorial role that he held when he was running the PKK from Syria, in order to make it easier for Erdogan, in my opinion, to reach an accommodation that would suit the prime minister. Why does he do this? Because Öcalan, in many ways, is seen as easier to manipulate. Öcalan is isolated. He has limited information about what's going on. He has limited contact with people on the ground, with political representatives, with Kurds. And because Öcalan isn't actually the experienced negotiator that he thinks he is, he's never been a real politician. And he doesn't actually represent people's mass demands in the same way that you can argue BDP does. And because, I think, ultimately, in 1999, Öcalan made clear that one of his main interests was getting out of prison. And so this, in many ways, was the perfect negotiator for the prime minister. In some ways, it's shocking, given the depth of the problem. Remember, this is a problem that has legal ramifications, constitutional issues, military issues. You could have thought that Erdogan would have chosen a more experienced, more representative interlocutor, but he didn't. So in my opinion, instead of choosing somebody, a group that could produce a democratic solution for the Kurds that could actually represent their demands, he sought to undermine legal representatives, the BDP. He did a very good job of weakening the PKK's political structure on the ground through the mass arrests of the KCK. And he also, at the same time, decimated, in some ways, the non-PKK Kurdish activist and intellectual class through the mass arrests that over the past 3 years of human rights members, lawyers, politicians, and others. Even the delegations that have visited Öcalan over the past few months have been stage managed by the prime minister. There's been every attempt made to cut any ability for these delegations to negotiate. The people have been chosen by Erdogan. He switched them around. There's been no continuity. In short, what Erdogan has wanted and gotten is an interlocutor with limited experience, limited contact, a dictatorial approach to politics and how you make decisions, and a real interest in doing what it takes to get out of jail. But tomorrow there's going to be an announcement, and this changes the dynamic slightly. We know it's going to include a ceasefire. I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say that. And it's very likely that it will include some sort of plans for a future phased withdrawal of the PKK. From Erdogan's side, this looks like a huge victory, and the Turkish media, for sure, has already hailed it as such. But it will only be a victory if Erdogan manages to continue with this process and if it develops into a further dialogue. And the fact is that Öcalan, as erratic as he is, and as much as he's focused on his own personal situation, he's laid out certain expectations. And he has made clear that in one form or another, the parliament needs to take the next steps to move this process forward. And I hope that Erdogan understands that Öcalan's popularity and authority really rests on his ability to continue to deliver. This is something Öcalan knows, and it's something that in some ways, despite what I've said earlier, does keep him as an honest interlocutor. But there's only so much he can give up before he loses his authority. And the prime minister has to be careful, in my opinion, not to push too far. So the challenge for Erdogan now, for the Turkish parliament, is to show it can grapple with the underlying causes. Because Öcalan is going to make, in most likelihood, a vague general statement and put the ball next in parliament's court, as it were, for parliament to set up some sort of system that would allow a phased withdrawal and to take the next legal reforms that are needed to somehow better integrate Kurds and answer their demands. And this means that the prime minister has to take BDP as a partner, because short of giving Öcalan a seat in parliament as an AKP member, that's all he has right now. And this means he will have to look, and that BDP, I believe, will push this at the underlying causes. What are those? They're legal changes that will give Kurds more equality. There are constitutional changes that will remove certain blocks on Kurdish equality. There are calls for self-rule that have been made both on the ground from Kurds and from BDP and in 2009 in Öcalan's own roadmap that laid out very clearly a roadmap for self-rule. At the same time, there's going to be a need for free political activities that are nonviolent, that don't call for any overthrow of the state, that would, in essence, allow the PKK to enter as a legal political party. At the same time, what are other underlying issues? Release of prisoners, both the PKK prisoners, who may number up to 10,000, and KCK prisoners, and an honorable return for PKK. These are the issues that have to be addressed for a permanent and a fair settlement. And it doesn't matter how much the Turkish government, prime minister, or Öcalan would like or be willing to settle for something else. The problem won't go away and won't be settled without these being answered. Erdogan has touched on certain changes recently over the past few months. As you know, there's been a few dozen people released from the KCK trials. They're still on trial, but they've been released from prison, which is a nice public relations step. There's the completion of the fourth judicial package, reform package, which makes some changes in how you can judge people for alleged terrorist activity. Fortunately, they don't go very far. And I think on the ground, the Constitution still remains very top-heavy. It's unclear what sort of changes, if any, Erdogan is in favor of there. And Erdogan himself has shown a remarkable intolerance for free speech. I'd like to just remind everybody about what happened to Hasan Cemal recently and how he was essentially forced out of Milyet basically because the prime minister didn't like what he had written. This isn't the sort of tolerance that is going to allow the free speech needed to reach a permanent agreement. You just quickly go, what are the gains for Erdogan for doing this? Why is he going even after this? This is something Ömer will touch on more detail. You've got the presidential race in 2014. Erdogan would like BDP support for changes that would give the president's post more prominence. And at the same time, there are regional issues. And I actually believe he wants to end this. I don't doubt his sincerity that he wants an end to the war. I just doubt his ability to reach and to understand what needs to be done on the Kurdish side. And there are huge risks now that Erdogan has started this. First of all, a poorly thought out withdrawal of PKK forces from the southeast leaves a vacuum that can be filled either by the village guards who are armed and angry and have all sorts of conflicts with local people. A combination of a poorly thought withdrawal with, let's say, a breakdown in the peace process could strengthen the Turkish Hezbollah. I met with their legal representative last year in Turkey, who runs an association in Diyarbakir, and I was surprised at how nationalistic he was in Kurdish terms. They have really changed their rhetoric. In some ways, they sound even more nationalistic than the PKK at times. Plus, they're arming themselves. This is a huge danger. They could fill this vacuum. And having Kurdish Hezbollah running around the southeast would be a big problem. At the same time, a lack of movement combined with a ceasefire could lead a possible split in the PKK. Young, radical members of the PKK who don't necessarily have the same allegiance to Öcalan as the first and second generation, coupled with a sort of disaffected youth in the southeast who have shown themselves to be hard to control in some demonstrations over the past few years, you could have the potential for a split. Remember, in 1999, you did have some people split off. You did have attempts to form alternate groups. It broke down in the end. But nonetheless, there have been examples of this, and I think there is more of a danger now than any time in the past. And finally, collapse of a peace deal could lead to renewed fighting, and really much bigger, and all over Turkey. And that's a big danger. So Erdogan started something, and it may look good, but he's really got to see it to the end, and see it to an end in a way that satisfies Kurds, doesn't just satisfy his interests. And I just want to say that I don't want to sound like I'm belittling what the prime minister is doing. I actually give him credit for this, and I think he's doing it at great personal risk to himself and political risk. But you know what? This isn't something that can be solved with half measures. And he stood back from Habor, and he stood back from Oslo, and I don't think there's a third opportunity right now to stand back and recover. And that's it.
Well, Lisa, very convincing presentation there. I think there's a lot to be said with concerning observations of Aliza, but still I'd like to turn to Ömer whether he might be able to salvage something a little bit more promising from this picture that Aliza has drawn for us.
Thank you, Kemal. It's hard to challenge Aliza's points because they make sense. But let's start with an analysis of the last 2 years. I think we are all familiar that the prime minister basically wants to become the president of the republic. So he has a plan to change the constitution and to basically switch to a semi-presidential system. And he wants to become the president. And that's the plan for 2014. And public opinion in Turkey overall considers the Kurdish problem as the most important problem, but because there has been bloodshed in the last 2 years, I think overall we have a situation where tackling the Kurdish problem at the time when the PKK is very strong, at the time when there is bloodshed, is not a political winner for Erdogan. A lot of people thought that he would just play it safe and not address the Kurdish issue until 2014, go for the basically security-oriented approach, not talk to the PKK, not engage in dialogue, not open another Oslo-like dialogue process after what happened in 2009. In 2009, with the Habur border incident, Erdogan witnessed that whenever there is a disappointment, whenever there are high expectations, and when there is a crisis, it's actually the nationalists in both camps that end up winning. MHP, for instance, benefited greatly from the Habur incident, and the lesson for Erdogan was basically to put on the brakes. He continued to a little degree, to some degree, dialogues with the PKK, but his goal was very simple: to stop the bloodshed, to stop basically violence. And his tactic, and that's where he's a tactical genius, in my opinion, is to argue, to essentially create a situation where he can address the root causes of the problem. The root cause of the problem is essentially more democratization. To talk about federalism, to talk about decentralization, to talk about cultural rights, language reform, constitutional reforms. But he realized that he cannot do all this as long as there is bloodshed, as long as there is PKK violence. So his top priority has become a ceasefire, disarmament of PKK, and to be able to address all these issues, the structural factors, once he has a deal with the PKK, once there is law and order, once there is some calm. And I don't think he's concerned about the vacuum that Alisa is talking about, because he believes that the AKP, his government, is strong enough to fill the vacuum once the PKK withdraws. He believes that the second most important actor in the region is his own political party. The only rival is BDP and the PKK. So in many ways, he's taking a very serious risk. At the time when the MHP, the CHP, the nationalist, the secularist, the Kemalist camp is very much opposed to this deal, is very much opposed to multiculturalism, is very much opposed to decentralization, he's willing to go that road, but first he needs to have a deal with the PKK which stops the violence. And his big question mark was whether Abdullah Öcalan is the right person to talk to. Why doesn't he go to the BDP? Well, here in this very room, we had the BDP leadership, Selahattin Demirtas, last year, and I asked him the question. The BDP is like Sinn Féin to IRA, and that's the analogy we often use in Washington. And he said that the analogy is not right because Sinn Féin has leverage over IRA, he said. He said, we don't have leverage over PKK. It's the PKK that is stronger. He basically made it clear that Abdullah Öcalan calls the shots, and it's very hard for him to do something against Abdullah Öcalan. Despite the fact that he's in jail, despite the fact that he doesn't have access to information, he is someone that manages still to exert considerable amount of control over the movement. And I think what convinced Erdogan to once again establish dialogue with him was the way he handled the hunger strike situation, the way basically he was able to send messages to Kandil and to Europe, different wings of the PKK, and at least he appeared to be someone that has a semblance of control over the movement. And more importantly, both Kandil and Europe did not really challenge the fact that Abdullah Öcalan should be the counterpart. I yet have to see basically a very strong BDP point saying we need to be the counterpart, not Abdullah Öcalan. They seem to be okay with Abdullah Öcalan being in charge. And the BDP may have also more maximalist demands than Abdullah Öcalan. So tactically, it makes sense for Erdogan to speak to a weakened leader who is in prison. That's why I mean he's a tactical genius. But in many ways, it remains to be seen, and here I agree with Alisa, that the strategic genius is not there. Because the strategic part of this problem, beyond the tactical victory, will be to address the root causes of the Kurdish problem. And the root cause of the Kurdish problem have a lot to do with constitutional change, have a lot to do with democratization, have a lot to do with a change in the political culture of Turkey, strengthening of democratic institutions, freedom of speech. And those are the areas where Erdogan is not very strong. There seems to be a kind of authoritarianization of Turkey taking place right now. The image of Turkey in the West is no longer a country that is in an axis shift towards the East. It's not the Islamization threat that we're talking about, but we're talking about more and more about a creeping authoritarianism in Turkey. And here, of course, the absence of an effective opposition is important. The opposition is in disarray, but you need to have a strong media, a strong civil society to oppose the government. in the absence of the military that used to play the role of a balancer, there is no more opposition in Turkey. Don't get me wrong, I'm glad that the military is out of the picture. The military should not be in the role of playing the balancer, but we need in Turkey a stronger media, a stronger civil society, a stronger civilian opposition. And I think those are the areas where Erdogan is missing. He's very much focused on the security situation. He wants to deal with the PKK. And as always, he basically kicks the can down the road and says, I will address the democratization problem once I become president. Once the constitution changes, once I'm in charge fully, I will go to the root causes of the problem. That's post-2014. Now, we can take him at his word, but obviously the Kurdish problem right now is the major impediment. And this is why I think the ceasefire matters. If there is a ceasefire, and if there is really calm in the region for the next year or so, that may create the window of opportunity for structural reforms, for constitutional reform. And ideally, one would have hoped that he would have addressed these issues earlier, because there's a clear correlation between violence and the absence of democratization. But he decided that he cannot address democratization while there is violence. So he decided to crush the PKK. He realized that the PKK was getting much stronger than it was in the past. The dynamics in Syria played a major role. He realized that he can't play a very active role in foreign policy in the region because of Turkey's Kurdish problem, because of Iran's and Syria's willingness to play the Kurdish card. He kind of neutralized the Iraqi front. I'm sure Gunnar will talk about the foreign policy dynamics, but I think the crisis in Syria led him to address the PKK issue and led him to believe that by just crushing the PKK, by just addressing the security issue, he won't be able to solve this. So he wocked to go for a dialogue with Abdullah Öcalan, and he raised expectations now. To conclude, I think we're at a very critical time because there's nothing more dangerous than raised expectations. The Kurds have very high expectations now. Not only they want cultural rights, but they also want, I think, something that is very similar to federalism. They want what they call democratic autonomy, which to me sounds like federalism. And I think the political culture of Turkey, the unitary nature of the Turkish state tradition, will not be able to address this, even with a new constitution. But the days when we could address the Kurdish problem by just ending assimilation, giving Kurds cultural rights, giving them the right in it to have education in Turkish, I think they're gone. We're at a point where there's a Kurdish generation in Turkey which has much higher political expectations. And they go beyond multiculturalism. They look at probably different type of models. I mean, Turkey should be at a point to talk about maybe a model like Catalonia in Spain different types of federalism. But we're not there yet. Those are the root causes of the problem. And how Erdogan will be able to address this, even when there is a ceasefire, to me remains to be seen. And I'm not very optimistic about his ability to address the root causes, but I'm impressed by his tactical genius of trying to get this ceasefire at the time when he needs a ceasefire. He needs calm in order to address at least the cultural dimension of the problem.
Thanks, Ömer. I think you brought us another very interesting perspective there. To the strategic picture, one must also add that the EU is not in the picture anymore. The only time when we saw major reforms that were adopted in Turkey with respect to the Kurdish problem was a time when there was still an EU credible offer for membership to the European Union. And that is also missing, and which additionally complicates the situation there. At the time there, I completely agree with Ömer that the demands from the Kurdish side have risen in the meantime. But I'd like to turn to Gönül. A fascinating aspect of this picture here
is Erdogan's and his government's relations with the Kurdish regional government itself, not to mention that there are now extensive, deep social as well as economic and commercial relations between northern Iraq and Turkey, the kind of relations that maybe only 4 or 5 years ago we would have not expected. Gönül, how this level of integration between Turkey and northern Iraq at large, and then this rather close, almost intimate relationship between the government of Turkey and the regional government in Kurdistan there, impacts on this this process?
Thank you, Kemal. I will be talking about Turkey-KRG relations, but I also want to talk about the Syrian crisis and the situation in Syria, which is a very important component of the equation. In 2009, when the government launched this Kurdish initiative, I think we had the perfect regional context. Turkey had the full support of Syria, full support of Iran and Iraq and the Kurdistan regional government. But due to the domestic context, it was a PR failure. So there was problems, I think, domestically. The Turkish society was not really, or the actors, political actors, were not really ready for the opening, and the opening failed. And now what we have is now it's the other way around. I think despite everything Aliza raised, I agree with most of them. There are problems at the domestic level, but I think we still have reasons to be optimistic at the domestic level. But regionally, I think it's a mess. And the Arab Spring changed everything. It reshuffled the strategic cards. And especially, I think the Syrian crisis has challenged the Imralı process in three ways. And I think the first one is, scholars have been talking about how the Syrian crisis regionalized the PKK issue. But I think the PKK has always been a transnational movement. So there is nothing new there. But what the Syrian crisis did is it emboldened the Kurdish political movement in the region, and which might be a problem because it might make Kurds less willing to compromise. Because the Kurdish political movement now thinks that we are on the verge of a historical breakthrough. So why do we compromise now? This is the first aspect. And the second one is, I think the Syrian uprising has turned the PYD, the PKK Syrian offshoot, into an important political and military actor. And that is very important. The PYD has been around. It was founded in 2003. But only with the Syrian uprising, it has become an important political and military force. And there are reasons for that. Why is the PYD so strong and so popular? And it has such important contacts on the ground. First, they are organizationally very strong. And they have a very centralized decision making. And second, they provide important services. They provide social services. They provide food, and medicine, and they carry out municipal work. And the third one is, and I think this is the most important one, they provide security in the Kurdish area. So they have, through their military wing, YPG. So all of a sudden, with the Syrian uprising, PYD is an important actor, and I'm going to talk about why that might be a problem for Turkey. And the third is, I think, we now have something which we didn't have in 2009, that is a strained relationship between Iran and Turkey. Before, Turkey and Iran reached an agreement, and they were cooperating against the PKK. Not anymore. And reportedly, there, according to Turkish media, in October 2012, for instance, there has been the Iranian regime cut a deal with PJAK against Turkey. And at least at the perceptional, that's the perception in Turkey. So the cooperation between Turkey and Iran is not there. And of course, there is the PKK's Iranian offshoot, PJK operating in Iraq, which complicates the things even further. So within this regional context, ironically, the Kurdistan regional government is the only regional ally of Turkey. There is a full economic integration underway. The KRG and Turkey has signed energy deals recently. And also, the two are on the same page on Syria. Both Turkey and the KRG, they want the fall of the Assad regime. And both are very concerned about the PKK presence in Syria. So they are strategically, they have become strategic actors, not just economic allies, but strategic allies. But this is not the whole picture. So imagine PKK might reach an agreement with the Turkish government, and it might agree to withdraw from Turkish soil. We still have the PYD and the PJK operating in Iran and in Syria. Because these groups, although they share the same ideology, resources, and the leadership with the PKK, they have different political agendas. The PJK's priority is to fight the Iranian regime, and the PYD has been trying to carve out a military and political role for itself in Syrian politics. So regionally, even if the PKK in Turkey agrees to withdraw from and disarm and withdraw from Turkey, the PKK will not really be organizationally dismantled in the region. And that's what Murat Karayılan, the acting leader of the PKK, means when he said that, commenting on the roadmap of Öcalan. He said, we will follow Öcalan's roadmap, taking into consideration that the regional context is in our favor. So that means mm-hmm. that if the PKK's demands are not met, mm-hmm. they will still have the organizational and military capability in these countries, and especially in the chaotic environment in Syria. So despite the KRG support, I think it's very essential that the KRG and Turkey are now finally on the same page. But I think at the regional level, the peace process will come down to what's going to happen in Syria. That's very important. What's going to happen to the Syrian Kurds? And there are a few different scenarios. If the PYD's military wing gains ground in Syria, that's a problem. That doesn't need explanation. That will be a problem for Turkey, because it will mean that there will be a strong PKK presence on Turkey's southern border. But there can be another scenario in which the PYD can actually become part of mainstream politics in Syria. And in that case, it might follow the lead of the KRG and establish maybe economic, cultivate economic relations with Turkey. And of course, if Turkey can successfully fix the Kurdish problem. But I think for the second scenario to happen, we need a few things. First, I think the Syrian opposition really has to address the Kurdish rights, Kurdish demands. Mm-hmm. And second, I think the Syrian opposition really has to deliver social services, because that's one of the strengths of the PYD on the ground. That is the Kurdish National Council, which was created. It's an umbrella group of Kurdish parties, which was basically founded by Barzani, and they have the international legitimacy, and yet they are not powerful on the ground. And it's because of this reason the PYD can actually work on the ground. And in the Kurdish liberated areas, they provide services. So if the Syrian opposition can actually step in and provide those services, I think that might integrate the PYD and might weaken the military ring. And of course, the most important thing is I think the Syrian opposition has to break the monopoly of the PYD in providing security. And now that there is an interim Syrian prime minister, I think things might move in that direction, because the aim is for the new prime minister to actually work within Syria and work on the ground. So this is, I think, the overall strategic and picture. And I would like to end on a positive and maybe a cautiously positive note. I think the Kurdish genie is out of the bottle and there is no going back. But at the same time, yes, there are problems on the domestic front, but I think the regional situation just complicates matter more. So there will, I think, certainly quite a few bumps on the road. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you, Gönül. Before I turn to the floor, I'd like to follow up on the gene that has come out of the bottle. I think the gene has come out of the bottle for some time. But the aftermath of the Arab Spring and the way in which the Arab world or the Middle East has drifted now into an even deeper instability, with it looks not immediate prospects of coming out from that state of instability, I have a feeling has triggered some new interesting reactions in Turkey. And one of those reactions is that, having bashed the European Union rather cruelly and liberally, I'm beginning to see in Turkey the beginnings of a desire to try again the European Union path. I think here also comes the United States. In Turkey, in the public, there is a recognition of the way in which things have developed in the Middle East. There is also a recognition that the only way in which Turkey may move towards, may continue to move along reform and economic growth, is by maintaining stability in the country. And I have a feeling that though the young people that Aliza has been referring to in the Kurdish ranks may not be appreciating this, this is deeply appreciated in business circles in the southeast of Turkey. Chamber of Commerce's, industrials, unions, etc. And this is, I think, Gönül, also reinforced by that close relationship that you referred to between northern Iraq and Turkey. This leads me to reach, or this encourages me to reach a conclusion that is somewhat a bit more optimistic. I do agree with Aliza's observations. I do agree with Ömer's point that the strategic picture there is missing, but I also wonder how long the prime minister can maintain his authoritarian course, an authoritarian course that may derail the economic performance of Turkey, the economic growth of Turkey. And I think we are at a critical crossroads in that respect too. And when addressing the Kurdish issue and these very recent developments, one need to be aware of that broader picture as well. And with those remarks, I'd like to turn to the floor and take questions. I would encourage you to shy from comments, or at least long comments. And when you raise your questions, please do mention your name and to whom you are addressing. I see. I'd like to take maybe two or three questions in a row and then turn to the floor.
the panel.
Hi, thank you very much. No comments, just two brief questions. First of all, I want to ask Omer, how exactly Erdogan's presidential ambitions settle with calls for further democratization? The second question that I want to address to any of you is how the imprisonment of Turkish officers affect the military in terms of command and control and the motivation of the soldiers, and did it affect in any way on the Turkish military capability to meet threats from the PKK or from Syria, from the PYD, etc.? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is another question for Mr. Ömer. It's also a follow-up question. Don't you think Erdogan is thinking about, when he's thinking about presidential system, one day a CHP leader or MHP leader can sit on this chair and govern the country, and then don't you think the design then he's thinking of is a little bit more reliable, I mean, more convenient for checks and balances?
Okay. One more question?
Yes. Hi, my name is Mutlu Siviroglu. My question is about the Syrian aspect of the issue to Gönül. You mentioned about Turkey, one of the motivating factors for the government is that the developments in Syria. I talked to PYD leader Salih Muslim a few days ago, and he was supportive of this process, but with the condition of that, he also mentioned that he has some reservations, some fears, that many Kurds that we spoke to share that the Turkish state might manipulate them, might deceive them again. So what do you think Mr. Erdogan is trying to achieve in Syria through the talking with Öcalan? So what is the ultimate goal that Turkish government is trying to achieve?
In Syria?
Yeah, in Syria. Yeah. Through Öcalan.
Maybe additionally, do you see any prospects of a relationship similar to the one with northern Iraq evolving? Are there signs of it? Let me turn to Ömer. I think you got quite a number of questions, and then we'll turn to Eliza.
Two questions on the presidential system from different angles. I think what Erdogan has in mind when he becomes president is the ability to have a stronger executive power and the ability to a certain degree to bypass the parliament with presidential decrees. He has a self-image of a democratic leader. He equates, in my opinion, democracy with a majoritarian understanding of democracy. He represents, in his opinion, now 50%. When he becomes the president, if he manages to create law and order and address the security dimension of the Kurdish problem, it's likely that a referendum on the constitution may pass with maybe 60%, 65%, and he will associate basically his vote with the 65%. So he will have this kind of almost I am the state, l'état c'est moi attitude, a kind of republican monarch, if you will, at the and he will address the questions that he thinks needs to be addressed, including, in my opinion, issues that have to do with freedom of speech, freedom of association, further decentralization. But he wants to do it from a position of strength. That's part of the Turkish political culture. Turks don't like to do big things when they're in a position of weakness. That's why they want to have basically a very strong hand at the table. He wants to strengthen his position before going for maybe a big democratization, big bang. But I'm not so sure that conditions will converge to create this. First of all, we have a situation where power has been personified in Turkey too much. And there is already a very centralized Turkish system. In my opinion, and that may be addressing the second question, which asks about different political parties' leaders' ability to come to the presidency. In my opinion, what Turkey needs is not the personification of power. We already have a political culture which is patriarchal. We already have a political culture where it's driven by big men. be it Özal in the past, it starts with Atatürk, of course, but then you always have these party leaders and not enough inner party democracy, not enough grassroots politics, not enough decentralization. To me, what Turkey needs is a stronger parliament, a stronger checks and balance, a stronger judiciary, a stronger grassroots, stronger regional leadership. One way to address this may be to address basically decentralization in a more generic framework, rather than talking about a Kurdish federation, to talk about different regions of Turkey needing decentralization and having basically a system where governors are elected, for instance, instead of being appointed by Ankara. I think Özal, to a certain degree, played with that idea of elected governors, seven different regions, all with a regional governor elected by the people so that we have a decentralization that would address the Kurdish demands without making it very transparent that this is about the Kurdish question, but more about generic democratization, generic strengthening of local authorities, municipalities. That's the kind of reform I'd like to see instead of a presidential system which will further centralize the system in Turkey and may exacerbate authoritarian dynamics. Not all presidents that we may have in the future may be as powerful as Erdogan. They may have different intentions. It may create basically political deadlock. I mean, think of France when they have one president from a political party and the prime minister is from a different political party. In France, they have this problem called cohabitation. It creates major issues. So I'm not sure that the presidential system would be the right way to democratize the country. But the real issue here is that Erdogan is still young and he still wants to govern. He still believes that he has the authority to govern and the legitimacy to govern. And when you look at the last 10 years, you can understand why. The economy is still doing well. Overall, the country is well governed. At the level of services, socioeconomic services, municipalities, people are happy with what they see. And he believes that he can actually address the bigger problems, including the Kurdish problem. And he envisions to still be around during the centennial of the Republic, 2023. He put the deadline 2023 for the EU. If by 2023 Turkey is not an EU member, he said, fine, we're through with the EU. But the way he talks, the way he campaigns, leads me to think that he wants to stick around for another 10 years. He can't do it as prime minister. He committed himself to end his prime ministry after three terms. He needs a different institution. But we shouldn't be at the mercy of basically one leader in terms of thinking about how to strengthen the institutions of Turkish democracy. We should have a more institutional approach. That's my issue. Very briefly on the military. Erdogan is very concerned, in my opinion, about morale in the army. That's why he went to the hospital to visit one of the generals. That's why he gave an interview where he said, we don't have admirals anymore in Turkey. They're all in jail. And he is concerned. And I would argue that he feels that the days of military tutelage and the days of military takeovers are really over. That's where he really differs with the Gülen group. The Gülen community believes that there is still a potential danger looming around. That's why they are more than Erdogan willing to continue the Ergenekon trial, willing to go after the deep state as they see it. That's the big difference. He wants, domestically, that is, there are differences with the Gülen community on foreign policy areas too. But if you think about the Gülen community as a very powerful political force in Turkey, the civil-military relations, I think, is where one area where you can see Erdogan being worried. I'm not sure that the morale issue has had a huge impact on the way the Turkish army fights the PKK or Syria. I think you still have enough generals, you still have enough of an esprit de corps in the military to fight the PKK, despite conspiracy theories about the military actually wanting to stick around and wanting to, in a way, strengthen the PKK so that they can justify their presence in the security realm. I don't buy really these conspiracy theories, but I think there is a morale issue at the political level. The military has lost a lot of prestige in Turkey. And Erdogan, as a politician who has to govern, who has to have a good relationship with the military, is much more troubled by the fact that the military now is in such a moral decay. I would say moral decay, but lost their morale compared to the Gulen community, who doesn't think that we should stop. I mean, I think that's the major problem that he has with the internal power struggle with the Gulen community.
Okay. Aliza, your reflections?
So basically on discussing on the military and its morale, I partly agree with Omer and partly disagree. I think the morale issue is a big problem, and I think more than that is the experience that's been lost with the jailing of so many top-level members of the military. That's not to say I think Erdogan's been wrong to go after military men accused of trying to undermine the state or that he shouldn't push them out of politics, but there's no question that there was a great deal of experience that the military gained in the 90s fighting against the PKK, and it wasn't easily gained. It took them years to really get the upper hand militarily. And a lot of that was lost, and I think that many of the people in jail are the ones who really understand how to fight the PKK, and morale is certainly low, and if you're an average soldier somewhere in the southeast, and you see everybody in jail, why do you want to put your life on the line? And I think we can see the sort of, I would argue that there's been a military parity in terms of the fighting the past 2 years between the PKK and the Turkish army. And I think it's partly, it's not that the PKK has gotten so much better, but it's partly that the Turkish army has lost a certain interest and certain experience because of the jailings. I just want to comment something on Syria and the PKK, which is that, you know, the PKK has, I believe that the PKK would last give up on the PYD. By that I mean that it's very easy for them to cut off PJAK, because PJAK to a certain extent is a smaller organization. It's very heavily dependent on Kandil. I mean, it's based in the same area. But for the Syrian Kurds and PYD, it's a slightly different situation. You have a huge number of Syrian Kurds in the PKK who have now gone back to Syria to fight. The Syrian Kurds have more of their own identity, more of their sort of camaraderie in terms of their fight. They actually control territory now there. And I think for the PKK, turning its back on the PYD would be incredibly difficult. And it's one reason that I think, you know, it's important to remember that lack of violence is not the same thing as a peace deal. So the only way to ensure that armed PYD members or YPG members in Syria are not ultimately used against Turkey is really to have a full-scale deal with the PKK, because otherwise that is always going to be the PKK's card, in my opinion. They're going to be, it's, you know, even if they were to say we want to, you know, cut off the PYD, I don't think the PYD would cut off from them. It's not so simple in the case of Syria.
And that's why I think a peace deal with the PKK has to address this, the PKK presence in Syria, which is going to make things even more complicated. Right. And as an answer to your question, I think the timing is important. We've been talking about why now. And yes, there are domestic factors, but regionally, I think the Syrian uprising has made the resolution of the Kurdish issue urgent for the government, because it has revealed that the Kurdish issue is Turkey's soft underbelly. And if Turkey can fix the problem, it won't have to worry about Bashar Assad regime or any other actor in the region using the PKK card against Turkey. And that's a strong motivation. And regionally, Turkey will definitely become a more confident actor in regional affairs. And even in Syria, I think it might play a more effective and maybe a more legitimate role. Because one of the reasons why Syrian Kurds kind of, they were on the sidelines of the revolution, because they were very skeptical about Turkey's involvement in the Syrian opposition. So if Turkey can deal with its own Kurdish problem, then it really can play a more, can be a legitimate actor, a legitimate force in Syria. And whether How possible is it to have to form the relationship formed between KRG and Turkey. Is it possible to do the same thing with the Syrian Kurds? I think it all depends on what's going to happen in Syria. I mean, if, again, the Kurds, they have to be included in the process, because if you don't, if you push them out of the system, whatever it becomes, then they will be marginalized. That will mean radicalization. So I think until now, Turkey's strategy has been trying to marginalize the PYD, and I think that's not the right way to go, because you really have to, it's an important force, and you really have to involve them in the process. And not now, but even for the post-Assad system. So I think it is possible. Why not? I mean, I don't think if you ask anyone 5-10 years ago, no one could really foresee this close alliance between Turkey and the KRG. So it is possible, but again, it all depends on the course of the Syrian revolution and where the Syrian Kurds will end up. So in that regard, maybe the peace process or carrying out these talks with Öcalan is just one way of Turkey's ways of dealing with the regional PKK problem. And the second approach Turkey has taken is forging close ties with the KRG. But I think there is a problem there, because Turkey has put all its eggs in the KRG basket, and there is a problem there. Yes, Barzani, he wants to be the leader of all the Kurds in the region, but at the same time, I think he has limited leverage. He has some influence, definitely more than Turkey, but still he doesn't have that much power. And you can look at, he's been trying to, in July 2012, he's been trying to bring together the KNC, Kurdish National Coalition, with the PYD. And there is no agreement between them. So he has a very limited role in that sense. So that's why I think the best approach is first, solve the internal problem through democratization, and then try to engage all Kurdish actors in the region.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Gönül. I'm glad that you referred to the relationship between Barzani and the northeastern corner of Syria there. Yes.
I'm Kemal Beyoğlu. I'm on loan to the State Department from the National War College, a colleague of Omer Teşvanar. My question is really for all of you. I'd like to have you sort of comment on Foreign Minister Davutoğlu's sort of concept of strategic depth and zero problems with our neighbors in light of the uncertainties or growing uncertainties of the Arab Spring.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Dakhil Shamov, Voice of America. I have a comment about Alisa's point of view about Öcalan's as a partner of this process, peace process. And she said that because Öcalan is isolated, so she suggests that BDP will be the better partner in this process. But the thing is, we see that BDP itself as look like they taking orders from Öcalan. For example, we see the strike before months ago. They end the strike by Öcalan, one word from Öcalan. So my question is, don't you think that Öcalan himself, as individual, become the center of this peace process?
There's one question at the far end that we need to engage the other half of the whole.
My name is Ehsan Gündüz. I'm a Kurd. The talks mainly focused on the talk between the leader of PKK and also BDP. As I was in Kurdish region just a month ago, and to my knowledge, BDP and the PKK are not representing the or not appealing to the most of the Kurds anymore. Do you think there will be a peace without an apology to people who suffered greatly during the war between PKK and Turkey? And also, all of you, most of you know that the Turkish government hasn't even apologized to the families of the Roboski massacre. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I think I'll turn to the floor and then maybe have one last round of questions. We still have a little bit time. Ömer, when I hear the zero problems policy, I can't help but look at you.
Yeah. Do I look like a zero problem? No, the tired old joke that you probably heard is that the zero problems policy is gone and that now we have zero neighbors without problems. Yeah. It's true that it was well-intentioned. I think it makes sense. It goes without saying that Davutoğlu is not the architect of this. It started before him. One can argue that the slogan of Atatürk, peace at home, peace in the world, is based on that. There's nothing revolutionary about declaring the intention to have good relations with neighbors. Yet where the AKP proved successful was exactly to take the Kurdish question out of the equation with the neighbors to a certain degree. Because when you think about the 1990s, when Turkey had problems with all the neighbors, it was mainly because of the PKK. It was mainly because of the PKK that there were problems with Syria, mainly because of the PKK that there were problems with Iraq and Iran to a certain degree, in addition to the Islamic Revolution secularism problem. With Russia, there were PKK offices in Moscow. Abdullah Öcalan ended up being caught in getting out of the Greek embassy in Kenya, so there was a Greek connection. So the PKK poisoned Turkey's relations with all the neighbors. Then in 2002, there was a sense of calm, and AKP managed to address the Kurdish question with cultural reforms. That was the golden age of the EU that you referred to, Kemal. And that was the time when Turkey engaged Syria. Turkey improved its relations with Iran, with Russia, with Greece. It started with Ismail Cem. So let's give credit to people before Davutoğlu who actually started that. Let's give credit to Abdullah Gül, who was the foreign minister and who actually was the architect of Turkey's EU momentum. Leading to opening of accession negotiations in 2005. So what happened? Why Turkey now has all these problems with the neighbors? Well, Turkey did not opt to have this crisis in Syria. When Syria erupts, can we say that, well, AKP followed the wrong policy? Well, AKP sided itself with the West. We could have easily seen a policy coming from Davutoğlu or Erdogan, which would have said, you know, Bashar is my brother. I really trust him for democratization. We should give him more chance. Let's engage him. Sanctions won't work. We don't need to alienate him. We know democracy took time, 200 years in the West. Why aren't we giving him more time? Instead of playing that game, they decided to side themselves with the opposition. Now, some people criticize that there is a now Sunni undertone to Turkish foreign policy because of the problems that Turkey is having with Bashar Assad, with Maliki, a Shiite, with Iran. So there is a certain level of Sunniification of maybe Turkish foreign policy. But in my opinion, I think those are products of Turkey taking sides. Turkey was unwilling to take sides before. The Arab revolutions pushed Turkey to take sides. And I think Turkey is on the right side of history. Overall, I don't see how Turkey could have said, you know, we still want to have a balanced relationship with Damascus. We still believe that, you know, we can do business with certain leaders in the region who do not respond to their people's aspiration. So I blame the failure of the zero problems policy not to AKP's short-sightedness, but to events. Events changed. The context changed. The vision that Davutoğlu had was the right one, socioeconomic integration, modernization, let's try to basically have incremental democratization. It didn't work. And I don't see that as a major failure of Turkish foreign policy. The problem we have now is the Kurdish problem reemerging again, poisoning to a certain degree Turkey's potential in the region. I think the image of Turkey in the Arab world compared to a couple of years ago, is more negative now because there's a perception that Turkey is unable to really solve its own problems. There's a perception that Turkey talks a good game, especially as a regional power which is willing to solve the problems. For instance, remember the slogan of Davutoglu, regional solutions for regional problems. That's wonderful as a slogan. You want regional leadership. He believes Turkey is the regional leader, a central country that should be able to solve problems. Well, Syria erupts, and if you're Barack Obama, and if you want to lead from behind the way you did in Libya, you expect Turkey to play a leadership role. So you ask Turkey, what is your strategy? How will you deal with Syria? And there they realize that there's no Turkish strategy. Turkey wants United Nations Security Council resolution. Turkey wants basically the Arab League. Turkey wants multilateralism. There's no Turkish unilateralism here. And there's no regional solution. We need the United Nations Security Council. We need Russia involved. So the limits of Turkish influence, the limits of Turkish soft, hard, and smart power has been proven in Syria. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, creates a certain sense of humility now in Turkey and the image of Turkey in the region because of the Kurdish problem and because of Turkey's inability to handle Syria. The high hope that somehow Turkey could have handled that has dissipated. In this sense, now, I think the credibility and popularity of AKP and Erdogan may be slowly diminishing in the Arab world as well, and opinion polls show that. Mm-hmm.
Ömer, I knew this was going to take a while.
Yeah.
Aliza, maybe the question about BDP and right, also and the very interesting remark that PKK and BDP may not necessarily be representing the overall Kurdish.
Right. So the real question is, you know, to what extent is Öcalan central and controls everything? And so I think you brought up the hunger strike issue, and I'm glad you did, because I think the hunger strike is a good example of how I think Öcalan's power has been misunderstood. By the time Öcalan called for an end to the hunger strike, everybody wanted an end to the hunger strike. The Turkish government wanted the hunger strike to end because they were terrified that hunger strikers would start to die. Kurdish people wanted the hunger strike to end because they simply didn't want their relatives to die. And the PKK, Kandil, by that I mean Kandil, wanted the hunger strike to end because they didn't have a plan B. They had called for this, they had supported this, and then should people have started to die, the PKK didn't know what to do. And that was a very dangerous situation for them. So at that point, to arrange for Öcalan to call for an end to the hunger strike was probably the easiest thing that has happened in the past year with the Kurdish issue. I mean, everybody wanted it to end. So it was a no-brainer to get him to say this. And it's not that everybody suddenly listened to him. It was that he provided the answer that everybody wanted. And he was empowered, essentially, by all the other actors. And I think that's really the point. Öcalan on his own is somewhat limited, but Öcalan can be empowered by these other actors. But that requires actually taking them into consideration a little bit. And I think this is the danger. By taking them into consideration, you get a slightly more nuanced understanding of the problem and of what's needed to have a solution. And this is where I think Erdogan may be missing the point, as it were, or doesn't want to accept that just yet. Now, on the question that, you know, Emma raised the thing, I remember when BDP was here and they all said, don't talk to us, we have nothing to say, you know, everything is Kandil. The fact is that there is...
Imrala.
The fact is there's a delicate balance. Look, Öcalan's an important symbol. He's a symbol of the PKK's unity, and he's the one example. I mean, the PKK is still the one group, the one Kurdish group or leftist group, whatever group, violent group you have in Turkey, that never split into nothingness. And really, the reason is because of Öcalan. And this is something Kandil, the Kurds, and BDP understand. They need him as a symbol to hold it together, because otherwise you could have a real split. And they feed off of each other. But that doesn't mean that BDP doesn't have a say. And I think over the past few years, since they came here, actually, when Öcalan was isolated even more, they became more active. And the fact is that all those statements that were coming out of İmralı over the years were not actually statements crafted by Öcalan. These were pretty much statements crafted by Kandil, passed over by his lawyers, and then approved on by Öcalan with some minor changes. So the fact is that Öcalan has not played that huge role that it looks from the outside. Mm-hmm. It's not to say he's not important. He needs to be part of any deal, and he will be. But I think even Öcalan understands that this is being passed over now to the next level, which will be the BDP and Khan deal. Mm-hmm. And finally, on the question of BDP and PKK not representing a majority of Kurds, you know, it's really hard. I mean, I argue they represent a majority. And I think you can see that through the voting patterns. You can see that through the support on the streets. You can see that through the demonstrations. You know, is it there's a certain core, obviously, of really activist PKK supporters, and then there's a group of Kurds who support the BDP and support PKK simply because it's the most it's the most powerful organization. And if you want to do something on the Kurdish issue, you need to be involved. And the fact is, the PKK and BDP have worked to integrate other groups into their structures. So during the last elections, BDP ran a slate that would have included HAKPAR, the Kemal Birkay party, but didn't at the end for an internal reason that had to do with who was going to be on the list and what number. But they did include Sharafetin Elchi. Mm-hmm. And these were really welcomed very much by Kurds on the ground, because even if they do support the PKK, they want to see a bigger ticket. They want to bring everybody together. So, you know, I still believe that, no, BDP and PKK certainly lead a majority of Kurds. You know, if ultimately you had some sort of local parliament, would BDP be the number one party? They might not be, but they would certainly be the leading party. So that's...
Okay. Thanks, Eliza. Yes, Gunnar.
I would just like to add something small regarding the BDP's role. After the third meeting with Öcalan, which was, I believe, on Monday, there was a statement. Öcalan, apparently, he criticized the way Turkish media portrayed the BDP as basically delivering mail. And he said that the BDP is definitely going to play an important role in the next phase, which is the drafting of the new constitution and the whole reform process. So the BDP will be an important actor.
One aspect of Öcalan that I think gets overlooked is that he has had a lot of time for reflection and reading. He's reading very impressively and interestingly quoting Jürgen Habermas in some of his statements. Is that good or bad? Is it a product of typical graduate student confusion that we tend to go at earliest stages in our lives? But I, on balance, look at it as something very, very, very positive. We still have a little bit of time. I can take two more very quick questions and then turn to the panel for final remarks. Yes, please.
Karwan Zabari with the Kurdistan Regional Government. Question for you, Dr. Tol. What do you see the relationship going between Ankara, Erbil, and Baghdad in the near future? And Dr. Tashpinar, how far will this message resonate among the PKK ranks, the message that we're waiting tomorrow? Perhaps yourself, Elise, as well. Thank you.
Thanks for bringing up the Baghdad dimension there. You had your chance. I think I need to turn to someone who hasn't had the floor. Please, it's right there. You can't see it. If you get up.
I have to get up.
Thanks.
Thank you. My question is for Ömer. You mentioned that Erdogan is a tactical genius. Staying at the tactical level, or rather the operational level, it seems to me that a ceasefire is pretty easy to understand. A ceasefire is a ceasefire until it isn't. But a withdrawal, which is also being talked about, is a little more difficult to measure. So my question is, how does Turkish government or the Turkish military intend to measure a withdrawal or enforce it?
All right. Maybe, Gunnar, we should start with you. If you have any final remarks, questions, Baghdad especially, the trilateral relationship.
It's great that finally Erbil and Ankara, they're getting along well, but I think it shouldn't be. Turkey is making a mistake. It shouldn't be at the expense of Baghdad. And that will be a problem, especially considering the fact that the recent energy deal signed between Turkey and the KRG. And it might work for Turks, because this is the calculation in Ankara. As long as we have a economically dependent KRG, as long as they're dependent on us, we are safe, and we are at the same time working on our Kurdish problem. But I think from the Kurdish, Iraqi Kurdish perspective, that is not a wise decision, because it has to be, it's a constitutional matter, and it has to find a solution within a constitutional framework. Otherwise, they would be just exchanging, they would, instead of being dependent on Baghdad, now they're going to be dependent on Ankara, which might be challenging for the Iraqi Kurds. So I think, especially with the peace process, if it succeeds, and remember, KRG is an important part of that. The KRG was part of the 2009 the Kurdish opening, and Barzani, he was on Kurdish TV channels in Turkey, urging the Turkish Kurds to support the opening. Mm-hmm. And now, the regional leg of the opening, the current opening, is the KRG. So Barzani is playing an important role, and thinking that economically that's wonderful, and politically maybe he thinks that by being part of that process he can actually have some influence over Turkey's Kurds. But with regard to the relations with Maliki, I think Iraqi Kurds, they first have to solve the problem with Maliki, no matter, he's been an increasingly authoritarian leader, and there are a lot of problems, and I think still they have to fix the problem within a constitutional framework. And I know the recent, the ExxonMobil, the Chevron deal, these are all encouraging the Iraqi Kurds to break free with Maliki. But I think in the long run, it will be in their best interest to find a solution within Iraq. So if everything goes well, probably they will, Turkey and the KRG will even get closer, and that might, of course, alienate Maliki. And it's not just a problem, the different stances with on Syria. There are problems with Maliki and personal problems. Turkey supported in 2010 elections Alawi, and that was a main problem. But I think Turkey has to engage Maliki as well, but I don't think that will be the case, because Maliki has already been releasing statements criticizing Turkey's approach, and has created some problems for Turkish energy minister in the Erbil conference. So I think that is not the wisest approach on the part of both Turkey and Iraqi Kurds, I think.
Thanks, Gunnar. Aliza, briefly.
Just briefly touch on the question of a withdrawal and managing the withdrawal. If this problem were just about the PKK withdrawing from Southeast Turkey, it would have been solved a long time ago. I mean, if this were the only issue somehow that could make the problem go away. But this isn't the only issue. And I think we have to be careful not to just focus on these sort of structural elements within the deal, because ultimately, remember, the PKK has a very strong civilian militia, militia supporters in the southeast. They will, if they do withdraw their forces, they will withdraw them right up to the border. And so they'll be just across the border in northern Iraq. They have a very strong force in Syria. So, you know, this isn't the end of the conflict. If it gives Erdogan room to maneuver, all the better. But the fact is, the PKK is certainly not going to disarm until there's a final settlement that meets all the political demands. And this is something that Erdogan needs to keep in mind, because otherwise I feel he will be very disappointed. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but Turkey will face great problems from further violence from the PKK. And this thing is that, you know, the extent that which Kurds now trust Öcalan, and it's partly that they do really trust him and they want to trust him. I mean, they want to believe that this is leading to a real process. You know, the opposite is true in terms of their feelings towards the Turkish state. They have zero trust in the Turkish state right now. I mean, I know this from being there. I know this from talking to people this week. I mean, there's nothing, zero trust. So the government is going to have to show legal changes. It's not enough to necessarily release people from prison and say, yeah, we did it, you see? Because in the back of people's minds is, well, tomorrow you can change your minds and rearrest them. So this has to be a concrete process, or there's going to be no solution.
Very briefly, there was a question about
the zero problems policy.
There was a question, to be fair, about an apology to the Kurds, and I think we should address that.
Yes.
I'm not very optimistic. You know, there's a long list of people that Turkey owes an apology. You may start with the Armenians. You may go to the Greeks. Istanbul had a population of 250,000 Greeks when the Republic was born. Today there are only 3,000 Greeks left, and the average age is 75. So it's a dying population. And the Kurds, of course, to a certain degree. But Turkey is not in the business of apologizing. Turkey is more in the business of creating a narrative of victimhood. We suffered. Who's apologizing for the Turks who have been killed in the Caucasus, in the Balkans? Who's apologizing for the genocides committed against Turks by the Bulgarians, by Serbs, by Russians, etc.? So that's the Turkish narrative. Maybe the PKK should apologize for its terrorist activities. That's the answer you're likely to get. I mean, if you had people like Orhan Pamuk here, he would differ. He would apologize, but Orhan Pamuk is Orhan Pamuk, and he would get in trouble. Thank God I'm not him, and I hope I'm not going to get in trouble. But look, the question about Baghdad. These are funny times. It's the Americans now who are reminding the importance of Iraq's territorial integrity to the Turks. It used to be the other way around. And it's the Turks who are preaching the virtues of democratization in a post-Assad Syria to the Americans. When Americans came to Turkey in 2003 saying, after Saddam Hussein, there will be democracy in Iraq, Turks laughed. And they said, why are you talking about democracy in Iraq after Saddam is gone? Are you so naive? Well, now Turkey is saying, after Bashar is gone, there will be democracy in Syria.
Very good.
Why should Americans believe that? Yeah. So topsy-turvy world, and Turkey basically is in a position to, I think, believe that the Kurds will have sooner or later a much more independent status. They already have an independent status. The big problem is Kirkuk. What's going to happen in Kirkuk? That's the time bomb. But the Turkish perception is we need to co-opt the Kurds instead of confronting them. We can live with them. They need us. We need them. There's a Kurdish federation there, Kurdish autonomy. Maybe in the future there will be a Kurdish federation in Turkey. Hopefully we can merge the two, and that's maybe the new Ottoman dream of our next sultan. So maybe that's the dream of basically having a larger Kurdistan under the tutelage of Turkey, which plays the big brother role. I know as Kurds you probably don't want the big brother, but that's how probably Erdogan is thinking. And on the question of withdrawal, the metrics of success for a withdrawal, very simple. If there is less violence, if there is a drop in PKK attacks, if there is a perception that there is now a window of opportunity for reforms due to a ceasefire, that will be the metric of success. I agree with you that an amnesty is easier than withdrawal, but at the end of the day, it will come down to how many Turkish soldiers are being killed. If there is a tolerable lull of violence, I think that will be enough for Erdogan to declare success and to go for the constitutional reform, the referendum. He has a deal with the BDP. Apparently, Öcalan is okay with him to become president. The BDP is okay for him to become president. And that's the sad state of affairs in Turkey. Basically, we're going towards a presidential system and without really having the institutions for a real democracy in Turkey.
Okay.
On that happy note.
Ömer made references to Orhan Pamuk, and it reminded me that when the Green Party of Germany held its party congress in Istanbul, I heard him make a very interesting remark, and I think that remark is still applicable. He said the region needs to learn to be less Turkish, less Kurdish, less, different ethnicities, and that it is through that one might actually be able to reach some kind of a solution.
More
there.
Less and more, but what? Swiss?
more, I think, comfortable with diversity and the kind of pluralist democracy that you have been referring to, yeah, which may elude us if a presidential system is brought in front of us. Yeah, and it would be yet another paradoxical, ironic situation. Yeah. We've made references to this. It is in an effort to address the Kurdish solution, Kurdish issue or question, that we end up creating a situation where we face what you called, at best, majoritarian democracy. Today, Ömer is my fan because he referred to Erdogan as young. And it happens that Erdogan and I were born on the same year, so that makes me feel good.
You should be the next president.
Spare me the trouble. I'm very happy here, and I was happy to be have you here. I really learned a lot, Aliza, from Ömer and Gönül too. I hope you did too. Thank you very much.